Consulting is one of those careers where not a lot of young people know what it entails.
I think it's like truly understanding the things that you care about, truly understanding the things that bring you joy, that bring you happiness, and then doing those things. The hard part is figuring out what that thing is. And I think a lot of like, you know, again, like the past few years for me is like figuring out like, okay, like, you know, I spent a lot of my life up to this point really looking to others to kind of gauge, you know, what's the safer path or what's the right path, or like, what are the choices that I should make that are going to set me up for success, success defined by, you know, others in society and so on. And I think more recently, it's been a lot of like, okay, well, like, what do I actually want to do? And then I'll worry about like success later. I did not find consulting. Consulting found me. And then beyond that, I just like own your career. Like if you want to, if you set a goal for yourself, like don't let other people get in the way of that goal. Like, go make it happen.
Welcome to the Edge of Excellence podcast. This show is for current and aspiring leaders that are dedicated to showing up every day in their lives with excellence. We break down the careers of those excelling so you can understand what is out there and how to rise up in every field you choose. Let's get the show on the road, shall we? Your host has spent his life promoting global entrepreneurship, helping 20-somethings find their passion, and working to help others achieve excellence. CEO of College Works, Matt Stewart.
Welcome to today's episode of Edge of Excellence. I'm your guest host, Sean Phelps, and I'm super excited to be with one of our old CollegeWorks interns, Keaton Petit. And Keaton and I got an opportunity to work together when he was a student at Kansas State University, and he's still working in the university world today, but in a totally different capacity. Keaton's in higher education consulting, and consulting is one of those careers where not a lot of young people know what it entails, how to get into it, and what a consultant does every day. So we're going to talk to him about his business career and how he progressed after college, graduating in a tumultuous time around COVID, to moving to Chicago, building a successful consulting career, and dabbling in entrepreneurship along the way. So I'm super excited to have you today, Keaton.
Yeah, thanks, Sean. Was that just off the rip? I mean, that was incredible. Did you have something written down?
That was just off the rip, man. So
wow, incredible stuff. Thanks, Sean.
So I love to start these episodes with how you define excellence. So we're here to help explore career opportunities for young people, help people figure out, what do I want to do? What am I best at? What are my skills attuned for? And like, what are some of these careers? Because you don't always get exposed to that. But also to do it in a way that you can be a top performer, you can be excellent at what you do. How do you define excellence?
Yeah, I think honestly, this is a question I didn't really think a whole lot about when I was in college. And I think I probably should have spent a little more time thinking about, as far as, you know, how do I define success or excellence? I think more recently, you know, this probably culminated a couple of years ago. I started going to therapy, asking a lot of these kind of questions myself of like, what do I actually care about? I think I spent a lot of my life really focusing on, you know, others' expectations, like, you know, what are the expectations my parents have for me, or what are the expectations that my teachers have for me, or you know, whoever it may be. And so I kind of let that sort of guide my way, you know, hence you going through the typical, so you go to college, you get a nice corporate job, you know, get a nice apartment, nice house, whatever it is. And I think more recently I've kind of said, you know, I don't know that that is actually like truly what I would define as success. And it wasn't really bringing me the kind of joy that I was looking for. And so I took a step back and just said, like, well, what are the things that I really do care about? And so more recently, I've been trying to kind of identify, you know, what are the things that bring me joy, for one, and like, what are those hobbies and things? And I think for me, to answer your question, as far as like how would I define success, I think it's like truly understanding the things that you care about, truly understanding the things that bring you joy, that bring you happiness, and then doing those things. Like, I think you're being successful if you are spending your time doing things you care to be doing. If you're not doing things that you want to be doing, then I wouldn't categorize that as success. I think, like, for example, let's say someone has a really successful business, like objectively, right? Like 10 million in annual recurring revenue, you know, they're making, you know, a million in profit off that. I think everybody would term that as successful. I think I would term that as successful if that's what they love to do. And truly, like, as an entrepreneur, like, that's where they really enjoy spending their time. If that is something that they, you know, slaved away at, now they're making $1 million and they're just like really not finding any joy in their life, finding any joy in the things that they're doing day to day, then I would say not very successful. So unfortunately, some things allow us to be more traditionally successful that maybe don't capture that definition. So like I would say, most people would say, well, you're making $1 million a year. That's pretty successful to me. And like, yeah, that may be true. And I think there are other things that people can be just as successful making 30K a year. Like I have a friend of mine who did the corporate thing and was like, I hate this. This is not for me. Quit his job, got a different corporate job, was like, maybe it's just the job that I have. Started doing that and was like, no, actually, I think I just am not meant for this. Ended up getting a job as a rafting guide in Southern Utah and like loves what he does every day. He's now started writing a lot. He has his own newsletter that I subscribe to that I love reading. It's called Pancake Morality. And he just like basically all these ruminations about the world. And I would consider him successful. Because like, I think a lot of people wouldn't, like, he lives this sort of like dirtbag sort of lifestyle of, you know, just he's on the road a lot. He's working as a river guide in the summers and then working as a ski guide in the winters. But like, I know he loves what he's doing. And I know that he is like, finds a lot of passion and joy in the things that he does every day. And so like, I would consider that to be successful.
That's fantastic. So what I hear is excellence is know thyself and, you know, be true to yourself, be passionate about what you're doing and be the best version of yourself that you can be.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a pretty succinct way to put it, better than I did for sure.
Well, I just had a chance in about a month ago to hear Nick Saban speak, and I've heard Nick speak a lot before on podcasts and videos of records, and he's a phenomenal public speaker, but I had a chance to meet him in person, and he consistently tells the story over and over again of the Martin Luther King story about the shoe shiner. That, you know, if you're going to be the shoe shiner here in Mobile, Alabama, you're going to, you know, be the best shoe shiner in the world. Yeah. That's what you love. That's what you're passionate about. If you can engage with people on a daily basis that, you know, whether they're a customer, a coworker, a friend, or maybe it's a patron on your rafting trip, that you can touch their day and make their life better so that they put up a sign that says the best shoe shiner ever worked here or lived here. Or, you know, if that's what they did, being that best version of yourself is truly excellence.
Yeah. I think like the hard part is not being your best self. I think the hard part is figuring out what it is that you want to be your best self with. And so like, I think finding that success in whatever it is maybe not the challenge. It's figuring out what that thing is. And I think a lot of like, you know, again, like the past few years for me is like figuring out like, okay, like, you know, I spent a lot of my life up to this point, really looking to others to kind of gauge, you know, what's the safer path or what's the right path or like, what are the choices that I should make that are going to set me up for success defined by, you know, others in society and so on. And I think more recently, it's been a lot of like, okay, well, like, what do I actually want to do? And then I'll worry about like success later. Like, don't worry about that piece of it. That will come if you're doing the things that you enjoy. And I think some people just stumble upon it and they get really lucky and that's something they find early in life. I think other people really have to fight for it. And so I think I'm, you know, finding myself somewhere between those two where it is like, I found myself in this position of, you know, conventional success, right? You know, I'm making good money, married, living in Chicago, got a nice place, like those like more conventional terms of success. And I think I'm still not quite there in my own terms of success because I'm still figuring out like, what is that thing that I want to pour myself into?
And it is the journey. It is.
100%.
So excellence starts with self-exploration and figuring out what I want to do, sitting in the park and thinking, you know, what do I enjoy? Do I enjoy problem solving? Do I enjoy service? Do I enjoy creating new things? Do I enjoy artistic exploration? Like what do I enjoy? So spend some time in the park thinking about that, figuring that out. And then what happens once you do figure out what you want to do? How do you become excellent?
I think that's
the easy part. For some people, that might be the easy part.
No, yeah. And again, I think like that for me is the challenge is what is that thing? I think the other thing that, especially like, I know I definitely got caught up in, and I think a lot of people my age get caught up in because of social media and seeing these, like, I mean, we were just talking about before the podcast, right? There are some people who, you know, stumble upon this thing and it just blows up. But like that is, those are the minority of stories, I would say. I think those are the ones that you hear about. But ultimately, like, as you said, like it's about the journey. And ultimately, these things take time. And so, for example, more recently, I've kind of identified, and I think I've always known this in the back of my head, that one of the things that I really, really, really would love to create in my life is a, this is not something new, but it's just something that I'm passionate about and I think would be value, is finding a niche in my community in through the lens of like a bookstore, essentially. And so I want to be able to create a bookstore that is ingrained within the community, has relationships with schools, is developing kids' reading abilities, is donating books, but is also a place that people can come to learn and engage and debate with people they don't know and learn about themselves and their community and the world. And like, for me, that was something that that's this kind of thing that I want to do. That's off in the distance. So now I've sort of identified this thing. The question then becomes, well, how do I get to that thing? I think it's all about just like putting yourself in spaces that are close to that, or that could see you, that could put you in a position to get there at a later date. And so for me, I don't really know a whole lot about bookstores function. I mean, I could postulate, like, generally speaking, right? You buy books, you sell books, pretty simple. But like, for me, it was, okay, I have this local bookstore, it's a used bookstore, it's close to me, that does some of those things that I mentioned. And I said, well, why don't I just start volunteering there? And so I volunteer there every weekend now for a couple hours. Every 4 weeks, after 8 hours, I get a free book. So sweet. But like, that for me is, I can be close to this place that I get a lot of enjoyment. I mean, I love just being there, but also I'm learning a lot. I'm learning a lot about how the business functions, about how they operate, about how they start new relationships, about who engages with the bookstore, when's high traffic, when's low traffic, like all of these different things. So that eventually, when the time comes, when I have, you know, Paige is no longer, my wife is no longer in school, and I actually have the opportunity to invest in this vision that I have, that I already know all of the things to be able to make that happen. And so I think, again, I think the challenge in some ways is, once you then figure out that thing, again, how do you find that success? And I think it's just like, you just have to let it happen over time. Like, I don't think it's like if I do this thing, I'm going to achieve success. Like, if I make this action, I'm going to achieve success. I think it's just like taking the most immediate actions available to you and just doing them. So like, for me, that was, okay, I'm going to start volunteering. But I also, like, I scan their hosting boards pretty frequently to see if jobs open, to see if the right opportunity comes up that matches up with my skill set. Because then if I can ingrain myself in the business and learn more, that's only going to benefit me more when I then decide to make that jump. And so, like, whatever that thing is that you ultimately want to be successful in, I think just like, just do the things. Like, I think it really is as simple as just do the thing most immediate to you that you're going to find joy in. For me, that was volunteering. And this is like one area of my life. There are certainly areas, other areas, but I just use that as an example to say, like, I think in college, it's if you want to be successful in college, I always tell students, because I interface with students through my job sometimes, it's just like, just get involved. Like, if you want to be successful in school, if it's about who you know, who you can connect with. And the easiest way to do that is to get involved. Find an organization that speaks to something that you care about. Get involved in it. Meet with your professors during office hours when you have questions. Like, develop those relationships. The more that you do that, the easier it is when you apply to a selective organization. The easier it is that when you start applying to jobs, you can speak to these organizations that you care about, that you are involved with, and so on. So really, I think it is just like, don't think about this thing you're trying to attain. I think it's just think about, like, what is the thing that I can do in the most immediate term that is going to be of value to me, or going to simply just be a good way to spend my time. I think, because otherwise you probably just catch yourself either doing things you don't actually care about or doing nothing, like sitting and scrolling on YouTube or whatever it may be. And so if you don't fill that time, like, you'll fill it with something else, and it's probably going to be something that you don't care about. But if you do fill it with some time that you do care about, you'll just inevitably see opportunities come up. And I think that's just like the nature of it, is if you just follow the things that bring you joy, you'll eventually find an opportunity that arises. And that may take place tomorrow. Like, in some people's cases, that may take place in 5 years. Like, others, that may take place in 10. This is kind of funny, but like Picasso, for example, I don't know if you've ever heard this, but had tons of careers. He didn't become a painter until his 40s. So like, he was like, this nobody dude. He had tons of different careers, tried all of these different things. And then in his 40s, he like, just like took up painting. He was awful at it. And just like, just tried painting everything. That's like, I go to Chicago Museum, Art Museum, and they have several of his paintings there in the Impressionism section. And he does these studies very commonly. So there's like haystacks. This dude literally painted like 50 haystacks, just like over and over and over and over and over. And now they're literally in a museum worth millions of dollars of these like paintings of haystacks, you know? So it's like, he wasn't like thinking about having $1 million paintings in an art museum, he was just like, I'm just going to paint these haystacks because I think I'll get some joy out of like practicing my painting, you know? And like the result was these things are worth millions of dollars and sitting in a museum and gilded frames and people are oohing and aahing and taking pictures. And like, I think that is a good analogy to like, don't focus on the $1 million or whatever in, you know, annual recurring revenue. Just do the thing that like you think is going to develop you most and provide you the most joy.
Awesome. So talked a little bit about your early experience and advice you'd give to college students, but talk about, you know, where you were at in high school and college. It sounds like kind of searching for and maybe following a path of I'm just going to do the successful things that I'm supposed to do or I think I'm supposed to do. But what were you thinking about getting into careers wise? And I don't think you knew higher education consulting existed when you were in high school. So how did you find, or let's start with your high school and college days. What were those like?
Yeah. So, and I'm trying to like fact check myself on the Picasso thing. I don't know if it was Picasso. I'll just be honest. So full disclosure, it could be a different painter, but I do know that the story is true for one. But anyway, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I had no idea what a consultant was. In fact, I didn't even know what consulting was as a career until like my senior year of college, like literally months before I accepted my offer. I had no clue what consulting was. So most of my life, I, you know, had a very entrepreneurial, to use the like cliche, entrepreneurial spirit when I was young. I mean, like I think as early as like 5 or 6 years old, what I used to do is after Halloween, I would keep my candy instead of eating it. And I would sell it the next day to the kids that had already ate their candy because I was like, there's a market here, right? There's like, everybody's eating their candy too quickly.
Candy addicts, I can sell they're it. Fresh out of candy. I've got
exactly. It. They're fresh out of candy and I've got it. It's on their minds. So, you know, I would do stuff like that. There was at one point, I think I was like 8 or 9 that I like really got into origami. And so like I had made a bunch of stuff and I set up a little shop on my front porch and like sold origami. And like, I specifically remember like FedEx dude coming by and like looking at him. He didn't buy anything, but like just like different things like that. I mean, all through high school, I bought and sold, did like barter and trade on like Facebook Marketplace. And there were like Craigslist and all these others. And like me and a buddy of mine did like 50K in sales over the course of a year, just like buying and selling electronics as like juniors in high school. So all that kind of stuff. So most of my life, I had some sort of entrepreneurial venture that I was engaged with. And then around my senior year, I mentioned that independent study where when we were talking earlier, a friend of mine was like, hey, you should do this independent study. And my mom came to me with this idea of this app. She worked in special education. And she said a lot of my special ed teachers really struggle with doing this calculation to determine whether a student should have a change in their hours with a sped teacher. And it's like a fairly simple calculation, but it had some stipulations to it. So I had never programmed before. But I lobbied with a former teacher of mine and said, hey, can you, you know, supervise me for this thing? I'm going to build this app over the course of the semester. And so I taught myself how to program and went through the jump through the hoops of, you know, the Apple App Store and ended up, you know, developing a full graphical user interface and everything behind, you know, this sort of app and ended up going to conferences with my school district, you know, selling the app and all these different things. And so I always knew that there was this cross between, you know, entrepreneurship and kind of, you know, critical thinking, analytical thinking, problem solving. Those have always been my strengths. Then coming to school, you know, my first year of college, obviously did CollegeWorks, had a what is now an average business, did a little over 100K. And, you know, from there, went through most of my college career as a major in finance. I had a couple of little detours where I'd always kept finance, but there was times where I was like a finance and accounting double. And then I was a finance and computer science double, but then the computer science became a minor because I was like, I actually don't want to be a programmer. And then I was a dual with management information systems. And I was like, you know what? That stuff just really doesn't do it for me. And so I ended up staying all through finance. And then, you know, getting to my senior year of school, I was kind of like, I don't actually know what I want to do. Like, I don't know what job I should get or like what job I want even, or even if I, you know, want a job or if that's the path for me or whatever. So the year prior to that, or the summer before my senior year, I interned at what was then Sprint before they merged with T-Mobile. And I was hired into their strategic pricing unit. And they didn't really, they were like, do you want to do this work? Which is like the work of what their core employees, I'm blanking on the title at the moment, but they just do a lot of negotiations. And I was like, eh, not really. And they were like, well, we have all of these other analyses that we've been meaning to do to really understand like if our pricing strategies are working or if not, and when we're using them and how that tracks with consumer interest and so on. And so I said, well, I'll do that. That sounds interesting. And so I ended up acting, at the time I didn't know this, but I ended up acting as an internal consultant for their strategic pricing unit. You know, it was very much structured like a engagement is now for consulting. So I started at the beginning sourcing data, having conversations with individuals in strategic pricing to understand, you know, what were the processes they went through, things like that. I then went through and built out this model with a bunch of takeaways. And then at the very end, you know, presented those takeaways out to leadership. And it was really, really great. They were impressed by the work that I had done. They actually ended up taking my analyses and my models. And it, as far as I understand it, they then used it for a couple of years after I had left. But I was describing this to a friend of mine and he was like, it sounds like you were a consultant. And I was like, what do you mean? Like what? And this is literally like my first semester freshman year. And mind you, I accepted a consulting position March, second semester of my senior year. So I was like way behind the curve. Most people applying to consulting positions are doing so the fall of their senior year. They probably interned with a consulting firm after their junior year. So I was way behind. But I ended up, you know, kind of hearing, he kind of described to me what it was. And I mean, it's all those things that I said, right? It's problem solving. It's analytical thinking, critical thinking. It's very entrepreneurial in a lot of sense. I mean, like a lot of the work that we do, especially at, you know, the director plus level, which I'm a manager now, but director would be kind of the next step there in that cadence or in that pathway. It's like you go and you sell this work, you work with the client to figure out what is truly their problem and how can we work to solve that. And then you build a team around that solution and then you go and produce that solution. And so it's very entrepreneurial. And so I was like, wow, that actually does sound interesting. It sounds like a great place to at least start my career. And so I ended up in a conversation with the president of the institution through a student organization, like I was saying earlier, like get involved. This is through a student organization that I was a part of on campus. Ended up getting some FaceTime with the president of the institution. And he was like, hey, have you ever heard of Huron Consulting Group? They're doing some work for us right now. And I was like, no, I haven't. He's like, they're a great consulting firm. There's not a single person I've worked with them that I didn't like. Incredibly intelligent people. If you want to do consulting, you should check them out. So what I did was I went on LinkedIn and basically just said, are there any Kansas State? So I went to K-State. Are there any K-State grads that work there? There was one. And so I contacted him and said, hey, can you grab 30 minutes? And he said, absolutely. And so I got on a phone with him and basically at the end of it just said, how can I get involved? He said, send me your resume. Send him my resume. He submitted it internally. I got an interview. I went through like 4 or 5 rounds of interviews. And then finally got an offer. And then I was like, oh, sweet. I have an offer for, you know, a pretty more money than I thought that I would make coming out of school. And so, you know, I had that and a couple other offers on the table. And that was really the one that was of most interest to me. And so long story short, I did not find consulting. Consulting found me. It was very much something I stumbled upon. And like, this kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier in that, like, I knew that I kind of enjoyed that work and this opportunity happened to stumble upon it because, you know, I was doing things that I was interested in. And so, no, it was not something that I was aware of as a high school student and not even something I was aware of as a college student. But now, you know, post-grad, it's like, I mean, I've been doing it for almost 5 years now and it's treated me pretty well. So.
Very cool. So what would a current college student not know about what it takes to be successful as a consultant or what the career of being a consultant looks like?
I mean, I think a lot of for one, you know, consultants used to travel a ton, right? So it used to be Monday through Thursday, you left Sunday night, you went to your client site, you were there until Thursday evening or Friday morning, and then you came home and then you did Friday either at home or Friday in the office. Now, I mean, I work from home almost 100%. There's a group of folks here in the Chicago office that go into the Chicago office on Thursdays. I do every once in a while. And then other than that, I mean, I travel for clients every so often. And then I traveled in late March. So maybe, you know, a couple times a quarter I travel now. So that's definitely one big difference. As far as like how to be successful in consulting, frankly, I feel like it's like any other corporate job, right? Like, I think the biggest thing that I've learned is there's a lot of value, and I think it's incredibly underrated that if you just do what you say you're going to do, you'll do just fine. Like, it sounds like such a low bar, but the number of people who just don't follow through is staggering. And so if you can be that person for someone that just does what you say you do, you're going to have a great, like, you'll be just fine. I think for me, like, honestly, the biggest thing for me has been I find someone, you know, that I'm working with, they say they need this thing. And it's like, okay, here's that thing that you needed. And also I went a couple steps ahead and thought about how this is going to impact the project. And here's what comes after that as well. Like, such a cliche, but like, if you can make your job's boss, if you can make your boss's job easier, your boss is going to love you. You're going to then become the boss faster. And then the goal is to find people who can make your job easier while you're making your boss's job easier. And I mean, like, that's like, again, like, this is why it's like, I don't think any of that is super surprising, because that really is sort of how the corporate world is structured. It's hierarchical. At the end of the day, it really is about how can you deliver on what you've been asked. And I just think there's so many people who, for whatever reason, you know, they forget, or, you know, they don't actually like the work. They don't find any joy in it. They have other personal things going on, but they just don't follow through on whatever it is that they've been asked of, you know, whatever it is that's been asked of them. And I think if you can do that, like I said, you'll be set up well. So nothing like groundbreaking here, but I really do think it is, it's that simple. And beyond that, I just like, own your career. Like, if you set a goal for yourself, like, don't let other people get in the way of that goal. Like, go make it happen. So like, for me, I really wanted to get manager in 4 years, which is fairly uncommon. There's maybe a few people who go from campus hire to manager in that time range. It's more typical to take 5 to 6. And I had a managing director who's kind of at the top of the totem pole in the consulting world. You can think of it like a partner, essentially, at like a law firm is like it's very similar. And he came to me and said, you know, here's the structure that we're thinking. We're going to have you as like the functional consultant. We have so-and-so as a manager, this person as the director, and then I'll be MD. And I said, okay. And then I took it and I flipped it and I found someone who could do my job. I proposed myself to be the manager. And then I said, if we do it this way with me at manager, then you grow me as a manager. We can bring more people into this type of work. The work that we were doing was a really statistics heavy internal equity review of compensation to understand if people were being equitably compensated based off race and gender at this institution. And so I said, we know we're going to sell more of this work, maybe not so much anymore, but at the time we knew we were going to sell a lot of the work. And so I said, we need to bring more people in on this. I can't be the only one who knows this methodology. I know it really well. I can manage it. And because you had priced this work at a manager, I'm only a senior associate. I cost less, so we'll have higher margins. And they said, you sold me. And so I was able to go in and be a manager without the title, without the pay, but show that I could do the work. And then that was a huge component of my case to be promoted, because I was like, look, I'm already doing this and I can already do it well. And we had really, really, really good responses from that engagement. And so that was a very early career advice from one of the people that I worked with, was like, own your own career, own your own development. Don't depend on other people to develop you. If you want to grow in this company, like, do it yourself. And if you do that, I think you'll find that people respond to it.
Yeah, this is, I mean, you present it as just, oh, this is basic stuff. And yet, how many people don't do some of the things that, you're talking about?
That's exactly about what I'm saying, right? It's like, I really do think it is that simple. And I think people really overcomplicate it. Like, just do what you say you're going to do. And if you do that, like, people will be like, oh my gosh, Keaton, he's on top of it all the time. And it's like, I'm not really on top of it. Just someone asked me to do XYZ and I did XYZ. But other people aren't doing that. And so it makes me your top performer or whatever. And in reality, it's just like, well, no, they said this was the deadline and I met the deadline. And so I really do think it is that simple.
That's incredible. Well, so you talked a little bit about an engagement or a project. And for people that understand even less, I got to talk to you about this a little bit before the show of what that looks like. So essentially, you know, you described it as we're just like any other service business. You need something done. You need your plumbing done or you need your house painted. You hire somebody to do it. You pay them the money. They come, they do it. And that's essentially what you're doing, but in a very particular area that requires a lot of intelligence, a lot of strategic thinking. And I got some more follow-up questions on this too, of how you think it'll change in the future with AI and all that. But just with what it is today, you know, what does a consulting project look like?
Yeah, I'll use the analogy that I used when I described it to you earlier, Sean. But maybe for those who have experience with College Works in some capacity, I'll use that as an example, right? So instead of door knocking, where you go around and you knock on people's door and say, hey, you want a free estimate? What we do is we source requests for proposals. So with College Works, you go around, you knock on a door, do you want a free estimate? You do your estimate. You say, here's how much it's going to cost to perform, you know, paint your house or whatever the service might be. From there, you know, the client looks at it and they say, okay, yeah, this looks good. Or, you know, maybe they say, I want actually, let's change around. I want easy eaves of the same colors of the house instead of different colors of the house.
I still remember that, right?
I want easy eaves, not hard eaves, right? Okay, great, cool. That's going to save you X amount, all right? You know, let's work on the price together, right? So it's really the same, right? And then they pay you money, you perform that service, you know, everybody's happy. Consulting work is no different. The only difference is the work that we're performing. So like, it's called professional services for that reason. So how it works a little bit differently is a higher education institution. Again, I'm in the higher ed industry, but this happens across all industries. Let's just pick a college, right, or institution, university. They say, we're really struggling to forecast our revenues over the next 5 years. We have no idea what our revenues are going to look like. And they maybe don't have the institutional capacity, be it they don't have the resources, or they just don't have the time to figure it out. That's honestly most common in a lot of places where we end up doing a lot of our work. It's not because the institution doesn't have the people, meaning they don't have the institutional knowledge to get that work done, but they just don't have the time. They don't have the capacity. And so they hire on an external consultant to do it. Now, in some places, they really don't have the people to do it, and they do need kind of our strategic thinking to come in. But ultimately, they send out a request for a proposal or an RFP, and it says, hey, we need help solving this problem. And here's what we think that solution might look like. And then what we do is we submit a proposal along with a bunch of other professional services firms. And we say, here is how we're going to solve your problem. And then they essentially, you know, the institution goes through the selection process and then says, okay, yeah, you're going to be the firm that you're the firm we've selected to perform, you know, this work, but we think it should cost $100,000 less or, you know, whatever. And we go through negotiations, ultimately we agree upon it. Then on our side, we establish, okay, who's going to be the team that does this? We pull together, you know, a number of consultants, structure it, and then, you know, we start the process. We then go through what we proposed we were going to do. We just execute on that work. At the end of that work, they pay us dollars. We've solved their problem. Everybody's happy. So it's really no different than any other service, be it painting or plumbing or anything like that. It's just the service that we perform is a little bit different.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about what a typical service you might perform look like.
Yeah. So I think like there's a pretty general framework that I see, though this is not all encompassing. But I will say on a lot of institutions, it goes something like this, right? So let's say an institution has this challenge of, I'm going to use one of the engagements that I'm on right now. So this is a school of nursing at a private institution in the Southwest or Southeast, excuse me. And they're really struggling to understand how their students are moving through their different programs. So for example, in the School of Nursing, they have, you know, a Master's of Nursing, Master of Science in Nursing, a Doctorate of Nursing Practice, and all these other programs. And a lot of times students will come in and they'll start with a Master's of Science in Nursing, and then they take that and then they go and do the DNP, their Doctorate in Nursing Practice. But this nursing program, this nursing school has no idea how many students are actually moving in between these programs. They just know that it's happening, but they don't know how many. They don't know how that's impacting tuition revenue. They don't know how that's impacting academic capacity, meaning like they need to know, if I have an increase of 10% of students, does that mean I also need to increase the number of courses I'm offering by 10%? Or do we actually have the capacity today to take on those 10% of students or whatever it may be? So what we've been asked to do, and this was much less formal of a process. So we didn't go through a formal RFP process for this one. This was literally, we had a prior connection. The dean of the School of Nursing contacted the MD and said, hey, I need your help. Here's what we need. And then we drafted up a proposal, came to an agreement. But anyway, to start the engagement off, we really start with data collection. And this is very common. So first phase of work is always data collection or current state understanding. So it's like, how are things functioning today? Because coming in as an external consultant, you would think in some cases that we just come in and say, here's your solution, and we install that solution. I'd say what's really not necessarily special, but what some consulting firms do and what some don't, or where there's a big differentiator, is some will come in and they'll just install a solution, right? They're often a little bit cheaper, they're less customized, less tailored. Something that we do, and many other consulting firms do as well, so I'm not trying to say we're like unique in this, but something that we come in and do is, so we have this general idea of a solution, but we need to come in and understand, how do things function today? What are the actual challenges that you're facing? So we have a general idea of the challenges just based off this, you know, proposal process, but like, what's actually like not working? From there, we may like complete, like I've literally seen situations where we completely scrap the statement of work, insert a change order, and be like, this is not what you need. Like, after really understanding what the challenges are, here is what we actually think that you need. Let's shift a little bit and change the way, or change what we're providing to you. So after that sort of current state understanding, that's really once you've then really figured out, okay, what is this thing that we're going to deliver? In the case of this school of nursing, now that we're sort of concluding that data gathering and current state understanding here in the next couple of weeks, we'll then move into this process of actually developing the model that we've sort of promised them. And so you really go through this sort of design phase, which is pretty common, where you're actually designing the solution. So you go through that. It's less collaborative. There is certainly collaboration, but it's more so getting input on like, hey, is this meeting the needs that you have, or meeting the objectives that you have? This thing that we're designing, is that meeting the objectives? And then, you know, after we sort of landed on the final design of something, we build it, whatever it may be. In this case, it's, you know, it's an Excel-based forecasting model for academic capacity and enrollment. And then at the end of this, you know, we really go through and then it's, okay, let's train everyone up on how to use this model. Let's make sure that it actually is meeting their objectives. And then we kind of go into that final phase of like, all right, here's how it works. What questions do you have? What more do you need? And then that's where oftentimes it sort of pivots into like, okay, we also identified this other need. And so there may be some continuation work where we sign a different statement of work and continue to help them in a different capacity, or we sign a retainer for the next couple months to just help the transition process of whatever that tool is. But that's like the general, I mean, like that's a very short engagement. Like this is literally an 8-week engagement. So very, very quick. I've simultaneously been on engagements that follow that exact same structure that are 8 months long. And just the work that it takes to get through each phase is just far more intensive, far more comprehensive. And so it takes more time, it takes more people. But ultimately, like that process of like understand current state, design the future state, refine it to some extent with stakeholders, and then ultimately pass it off or implement it is like a pretty standard sort of consulting process.
So when you're trying to deliver for the client and you've got to communicate with these clients, your team members and everything.
Are you enjoying the show thus far? We go through so many resources and links with this podcast, it's tough to keep up. I get it. That's why Matt and the rest of the team put together the Edge of Excellence Bundle. In it, you'll find different tools that relate to overarching themes and topics of the show. Things like DISC assessment tools, time management strategies and tactics, stress and anxiety management tools, exclusive videos and episodes from this podcast that is not released anywhere else, and so much more. The best part? As a valued listener of the show, you can access the Edge of Excellence Bundle 100% for free of charge. That's right, for simply being awesome and tuning in. To get access, all you have to do is go to www.collegeworks.com/podcast and fill out the short form there for us to get the bundle over to you. Once again, it's www.collegeworks.com/podcast. Now, back to the show.
How much of that is the soft skills that you got from your campus orgs, your work experience, your, you know, outside of the education? And then how much of success as a consultant is like, well, I have to know how to do all this crazy Excel stuff and do all this statistics?
Yeah. I mean, I think it does change depending upon the role that you're in. So like now as a manager, it's a lot more soft skills. My job now is a lot less about the truly quantitative nitty-gritty work. My job now is managing people and managing clients. If I were to bucket it into two big categories. And there's like a little component of sales in there as well. But like the core responsibilities for me are, how do I manage my direct reports and my supervisor? I think there's this perception of like, you're always managing down. I manage up so much, like really trying to guide my supervisors as well. So managing up and down to the people that I work with, and then managing laterally to my clients. And so like right now I'm on 3 different engagements, 3 different clients, 3 different types of work, which is pretty common. I'm typically split between 3 to 5 engagements at any given time. Very, at least for me, very uncommon that I'm on just one engagement. I do know some people who are a little bit lucky and they're 40 hours on one. I typically am split, and that lends itself to my expertise well or skill set well. And that's why I'm like that. Whereas other people really like to focus in. But anyway, I think it is right now for me, it's a lot of the soft skill. It's how do I get the most out of the people that I'm working with? And for some people, it's different for every person I work with. For some people, it is establishing check-ins with them, you know, on a like 3 times a week. You know, I meet with them Monday, Wednesday, Friday. For some people, it's like I meet with them at the beginning of the week and I'm like, hey, so-and-so, you know, here's the plan for the week. Here's what we need to deliver to the client. Here are the deliverables I'm working on. Here's the cadence, right? So I'm the project manager. And then I let them run and they can do it and they don't need that guidance and other people do. And so a lot of my job now as a manager is understanding if it's a new director that I'm working with, what are their needs? What did they need for this project to be successful? And then looking to the person that's, you know, technically reporting to me, but it's certainly more collaborative to understand what do they need to be successful? And if I'm making sure that everybody has what they need to be successful, like I think that's my job. Then laterally to my clients, it's, I know what they need in the sense that I know the thing that we're delivering to them. But I think the challenge there is every client is different too, to where some want to be really, really involved in the day-to-day and they really want to understand how are you coming to these decisions? What assumptions are you making? And then other clients are like, yeah, I'll talk to you in a month. Like, let me know when this is finished. And that requires its own sort of approach. Now, when I started my job, it wasn't that at all. I mean, a lot of my job was like, probably don't like this term, my company won't like this term, but Excel monkey, right? You know, like it was, Keaton, we need XYZ analysis done. And it's like, all right, let's like put on the headphones and like get into the computer and like sit here for, you know, over the course, you know, 60 hours of the course of the next week and just like knock out this model and just make it as best as I possibly can, right? And like, that's not my job anymore. I just have a functionally different role than I used to. So I do think when you come in, it really is like, and like the good news is that because I know what it takes or like what it looked like for me at that level, I think I am better equipped to manage people doing that work because I've done it before. And so like, I think that like, some people that come into consulting come in from industry. And so like we have people who worked at higher education institutions that come in as managers. And I think it's really challenging for them. In fact, I know it's challenging for them because I've had conversations with many of these folks where they don't really know the consulting process and they never served as an analyst or associate on these engagements. They never had to do that work. And so it's really challenging them for them to manage these people that are doing that work because they have no idea what it looks like. And so for me, having done that work, it makes my job a lot easier now to where I'm like, I know exactly what you need. You know, you need this direction, you need this guidance, you need these tips, you need these check-ins, whatever it may be, to sort of move you through the process because they don't have that experience yet. And then, you know, again, I mean, it just changes. And as I look, you know, and I'm still kind of debating on if this is what I want my career trajectory to be, is like, as I look towards director and managing director and so on, like my job would fundamentally change again. And so I think the advantage of sort of moving through the progression, you know, from analyst all the way up to managing director is that I've lived what those people are doing. And so it makes my job a lot easier. So like, honestly, I think there are many ways in which my job today is easier than it was when I was an analyst. There are also many ways where it's harder and, you know, more stressful. And there's certainly more weight on me to perform and make sure that we're executing for our client. But like, I mean, I used to spend 40 hours a week in Excel and I maybe send 2 to 3 now. And a lot of my time is like meeting with people and understanding that they have what they need to be successful. And so like my job is just like I view my job more as like growing people and developing people than anything else. If people are growing and developing, then like we're getting the work done because that's how they're growing and developing. But if that's the focus, it just works better for everyone.
Fantastic. So what do you see changing or going on in higher education in the near future?
Yeah, what's not changing, right? So yeah, I mean, I think with a lot of the, you know, recent executive actions, that puts a lot of strain on higher education institutions in a lot of different ways. So outside of that, though, outside of some of the more federal changes that have been imposed on higher education institutions over, you know, over the past, I mean, literally like 3 months, there has been a broader trend of less students are going to college, which means at the end of the day, a institution's customer are students. Like, I mean, putting like research and healthcare to the sides for a moment, like higher education at its core, the customers are students, be it undergrad, graduate, or doctoral. And so when you have less customers, that means you have less revenue. If you have less revenue, then you can't, you know, maintain the same level of service that you have been historically, which means institutions are slowly, you know, declining in size. And so as a result, there's tons of consolidation going on across higher education. And so one of the big changes that's taking place right now is lots of mergers and acquisitions, which is a space that my company has seen a lot of growth in for us in services and revenue because we're helping higher education institutions navigate that change. I mean, historically, like mergers and acquisitions in higher ed, like it didn't really happen, right? And or I mean, it did, which is not to the level of extent of like what you know the public sector goes through. So now that we have a lot of this,
schools just follow another school.
Yeah, literally. So like a
that existed.
And I mean, this is taking, I mean, we literally have a newsletter that comes out every month and it's like, I see a new list of 10 to 20 institutions that were merged or acquired with another institution every month. So this is taking place more and more and more and more. So that's one big major change. The other one too is obviously the move towards online has been a big piece of it. And so lots of institutions are standing up their global institution, global university, to where they're then offering these courses online. And every institution is doing this differently. Some partner with another company like Coursera, for example, where they basically say, here's our curriculum, but like you teach it, or we're going to use your platform, but our curriculum, for example. Other institutions are doing it all themselves, where they're completely taking
Get servers.
Exactly. So they have the curriculum, right, from their on-campus courses, and they're asking their professors, can you modify this for a online or asynchronous course? And then some of those faculty members are teaching those courses as well. And some faculty members are being hired on to just teach online courses. So that's another big shift. Another area that is becoming more and more common is continuing education. And so less students coming to get a degree and more students coming to get certificates or some sort of like, I'm going to take these three courses because that's going to help me with, you know, my career, or my job or whatever. If I take these courses, my employer says that I can, you know, get a promotion or whatever it may be. So that's becoming more common. All of this to say, so all of this happening at the same time, you're seeing students seeking baccalaureate degrees is declining, right? And so you have more students going towards tech schools, things like that. And so some campuses are expanding their offerings in that space. But yeah, I mean, like, these are like just some of the things that come to mind in the immediate term. And that's putting to the side, you know, some of the more immediate, like the dissolution of the Department of Education certainly will have impacts. How the Trump administration is leveraging federal funding is certainly having a lot of impacts as it relates to NIH and research funding, but also the endowment tax, potential changes to that would have very large ramifications for many institutions. So all that said, I mean, there is even more on the horizon that is going to, you know, hit higher education in various ways. And I think, you know, the challenge or one of my conflicting points with consulting is oftentimes disruption is really good for consulting. Like there's this old joke that like consulting is the place to be if there's a recession, because during recessions and during you know, times of high disruption, people don't know what to do. And so they go to someone and they say, what do I do? And who do they go to? They go to consultants, because our job is basically to be the outside observer and say, okay, we see this thing happening to you. Here's what we think is the best course of action. And so when university leadership are like, you know, holy shit, we're going to lose massive NIH funding, right? That's going to disrupt our research arm of our university at like massive scales. Like I think most people do not understand the level of impact that the reduction in NIH funding would have on scientific research in the country, both in like pharmaceuticals, but also just like general biotech and beyond. I mean, like we're talking about billions and billions and billions of dollars of research funding no longer being funded. And so the level of scientific progress that we typically have is stifled to a large extent because that research is no longer being funded. And so like, an institution sees this happening and they go, oh my gosh, what do we do? Right? Because they're just trying to keep the campus alive. They're just trying to keep people, you know, in their jobs doing the work. Right. And so they say, you know, consulting firm X, whatever, you know, whoever they go to, what do we do? And so in these times of major disruption, we sort of profit off of that disruption. And oftentimes that, you know, just the more challenged our clients are, the more successful we are monetarily. And that for me is very conflicting because, you know, ultimately I want my client to be successful, but at the same time, we're also reaping some of the rewards of them, you know, struggling. And so that is, I mean, I'm having lots of conversations with myself around.
We'd rather work on the project that's, we're growing too fast. And
Yeah, exactly. We need your help. And like, we don't know what to do with all this money, right? Like that's where you want to be. You want to be working on those strategic projects that it is really about defining the success of the institution. And today, realistically, like a lot of what we're doing is like, we were lost. We don't know what to do. Every day it changes. And like quite literally right now, every day it changes. And so we just have, we're constantly working with clients to reimagine how they go about the future of their institution, because a lot are just very lost and dealing with other challenges outside of all of this. And so it just all just kind of piles up, and that's a really tough place to be when you ultimately, you know, you want them to be successful.
Wow. So now we've got AI. And how is that impacting education and consulting both in your eyes over the near-term future? And, you know, is that a skill that young people should be dabbling in and exploring?
To your last question, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think generally speaking, whether it's AI or anything else, if new technologies come out, just like play with them. Like you don't have to be serious about learning the intricacies of what, like how a large language model functions and like what a transformer is and like all that stuff. Like that's some of the, like I've had some interest in that historically. And so I've dug into it, but like those types of things, like it's not so much important how it works. It's just, what does it do? And if you can understand what it does, you'll be miles ahead of the general public. And so like, I think right now it's AI and large language models and like, what do they do and what utility do they have? And so it's not so much understanding like, oh, I know what this is. And I can build them or whatever it may be. And I'm going to go work for Google and help them, you know, help and work on Gemini and whatever. It's just, I know how to use this and I can put it to, you know, my benefit, because that's going to be, you know, better than the, you know, the individual next to you who's maybe not using it. And so absolutely, whatever the technology is, whether it's something massive, you know, like large language models, or, you know, something small, like just learning a new software. Like I learned Smartsheet. In the last 2 years, it's the project management software. And I never had any intention of learning it, but it's just a better project management tool. And so I said, well, if I can learn this, then I'll do better at project management than the person next to me. And so like I learned the tool, right? Now, as far as how is AI impacting education and consulting, I think there's two very different answers. So I mentioned online learning. That's a big piece of this, especially because when you talk about a professor sort of teaching asynchronously, oftentimes it's just recordings. Well, you can give an AI script and feed it. I mean, you could train it on a topic and
that it
you know, it's
teach
not going
to
be
any language.
Yeah, that it could teach in any language at any time of day. You know, like, so like, yeah, you're right. At least on the right track, right? It's like, especially when it comes to e-learning. But I also think that's probably the biggest application on the higher education side of things. Now, with that said, where it's at today, and where it's likely to be in the next 10 to 15 years, I'm like making this like massive prediction. I'm probably going to be wrong, but like, I can't see it replacing the actual job of faculty members. I think at the end of the day, especially like me working remotely, I think you can't overestimate the value of actual people. Maybe I'm wrong. And like, as generations sort of grow up in this world where we interface with AI more and more and more, we do lose some of that human interaction. I mean, we've obviously already lost it to some extent, you know, over the past, you know, 50 years. But I just can't see a world where we don't have lectures, in-person lectures with a professor, with a true expert. And, you know, at least not, and maybe in my lifetime, honestly, but at least not in the next, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. It's hard to see that. Maybe beyond that, though, for sure. But that's on the education side of things. I do think that faculty, I mean, I've literally been in conversations where faculty or have been talking about this of kind of like, you know, am I going to lose my job in 10 years because you can train a model up on everything that I know? And it's like, yeah, but you can't train a model how to do the research that you're doing, at least not yet. You can't train a model to answer the questions and have develop the conversation or develop the relationships that you have with your student and your you know graduate assistants and so on. At least not yet. So,
well, and all that so said, I've heard in sales that there's a lot of predictions that there'll be a resurgence of in-person sales transactions because I can't really trust anything digitally because it's probably AI generated. All the emails and all the, you know, that message I got from somebody on LinkedIn is probably not even them. It's probably an automated system. Yeah. So, but if they're sitting in my office or they're sitting in my living room, then I know it's a real person.
No, exactly. And I mean, like you mentioned sales, when I was talking about traveling earlier about how consultants, you just travel a ton and now we don't. Well, that goes for sales now. I work with several directors and managing directors who they went through a brief period where they were doing all of their sales virtually and they've stopped. And they're just like, I have to be in the room. I have to be able to truly interact with that client, to be able to sell to them, to understand what their challenges are, to see the expression in their face and their body language and really truly understand like what's going on. How serious is this? Do they actually care about the opinion of the person that they call on, or do they actually defer to this person that, you know, is really quiet on the calls, but I noticed after our conversation that that's who they teamed up with after the conversation. So like, it's those things that you just don't get virtually. And I think that you similarly would not get from artificial intelligence in whatever form it takes, you know, over the coming years, that it just requires human presence. And so with consulting, I mean, we already use it a ton today. I mean, I literally used it today. We have a contract with Microsoft, and so I use Copilot. But I use it most commonly. I have this rule with everybody I work with. I should say never start from scratch. So if it's a new document that we've never done before, you can't find on any engagement that our company has ever done, you can't find something like this, go to ChatGPT and ask it, or go to Copilot or whatever it is. Otherwise, if we have some material, start with that material, but never start from scratch. And before, there was a lot of things, I think like early, you know, when I started my career early on, 2020, I was doing that. I was starting a lot of things from scratch. And then, you know, a couple of years later, you had ChatGPT, and then all of these other large language models sort of started coming out and improving and so on. And now it's just, you know, I was having to generate a graduate student survey. I just had to generate some questions. And I was like, you know, I have some general ideas around the types of questions that I want to ask. But instead of me trying to think of all these questions, let me just go to Copilot and put in like, hey, I'm conducting this study and I want to talk to graduate students about XYZ. Can you generate 20 questions for me that can be answered on a Likert scale and formatted in this sentence structure? Generates 20 questions. And then I say, okay, I like these ones. I don't like these ones. Can you modify them a little bit? Or, you know, I don't know the exact prompts that I gave it, but basically then I ended up with it and I took that off, threw it in a Word document and then refined it a little bit more to make sure I liked the language and that we were hitting there on the right objectives. Took it to my team and said, hey, here's what Copilot and I cooked up. What do we think? And they said, I like these ones. Let's maybe add in this question. I think we're missing this objective. And then we said, okay, client, here you go. Here are your questions for your survey. And so that is becoming more, that process that I just walked through is becoming more and more and more common. I think similarly, like another kind of application, and I think this, I don't think these are specific to consulting. I think these are just general. It's just like, I think this is like when the calculator is invented, it's like, don't do that by hand, use a calculator. It's like, this is no different. So like now for me, like I remember the first time I really used it for Excel help. I was building out this model and I have a little bit of experience with macros, but I was trying to write this really difficult macro and I just couldn't get it. So I went to ChatGPT and said, here's what I'm trying to do. Here's what I currently have written. How would you revise it? And I went from probably being heads down for a full day or two trying to figure this out to spending an hour. It was an hour. Like I still had to work with it. There was a lot of back and forth, but I spent an hour. By the end of that hour, I had a functioning macro that did exactly what I needed it to do. And I was actually thinking about this idea of like testing the correlation between the stock market and the media and trying to understand if media publications can predict movement on the stock market a day later, right? Because like recently we've seen like this, like how the stock market moves is like, what are the headlines, right? Like that is how the stock market moves, especially today. And so I was just sitting down, you know, had this idea and I was like, how would I do that? And I was like, well, I don't really know too much about machine learning. I know a little bit of Python, but I do have ChatGPT and I can go to ChatGPT and say, hey, I want to write a machine learning algorithm that basically writes a linear regression using 50 different publications inputs and a sentiment analysis to understand if it's positive or negative sentiment. And it should output to me which news publications have the most impact on what the stock price of the S&P 500 is going to be in the day after tomorrow, right? I couldn't do that myself, but like I do have a tool that can not only show me how to do it, but also write some of the code that I needed to write. And so, and especially like, I do think probably one of the best applications of these large language models is programming because there's so much rules, because it's very structured. It's a language. And so like a large language model, the whole point is learning the rules of a language. Well, oftentimes it gets facts wrong, but that's because it's about something else. But its language is great. Like ChatGPT speaks great English and Farsi and Mandarin. And like it, you know what I'm saying? So like, why wouldn't it also speak programming language? And it does. And so that is something that is like a really big application. And I think something that we'll find as this gets better and better is that web developers and software developers and so on, they're not going to be working on writing the programming. They're going to be working on the thing that writes the program.
Advice today to people in their 20s that are trying to navigate this world. I want to be successful. I want to find, you know, the thing that I'm super passionate about, the thing that I love, and go be successful at it. You know, we talked about being able to do what you say you're going to do is one of the most fundamental table stakes, but really does set you apart. You talked about managing up and managing down. I love that component. Using tools to never start from scratch. What would be, you know, talking to yourself 5-10 years ago, the biggest takeaways you want somebody to get from this conversation?
I think you said this earlier, take a walk in the park and like really like actually sit down and like think about like putting everyone else aside. What are the things that you like really do care about? And that's like, I actually know several people who are like, I loved college. I loved going to class and they really enjoyed that. And they really loved that style of learning. I've never liked school, which is funny because now I'm serving in higher education. But I've never really liked school. And so why did I go to college? Because that's what, you know, my mom went to college, my sister went to college, and my dad did, you know, took courses in college. And so that was like the path, that was the route to take. And so I think for me, it would be just like really sitting down and saying like, is that actually the thing that I want to do? And like, obviously it's landed me in a great place, but I do think that I would have served myself more had I sat down and asked some of those questions. I think maybe that's number one. Beyond that, I think it really is just, I'll leave it at that, honestly. I really do think it is just like, just sit down and really try to understand like, why are you doing the things that you're doing? And if you come to the conclusion that it's not because it's something that you want to do, or it's not because it's something that it, you know, that brings you joy, then like do the thing that does. And if you don't know, then like spend some time trying to find out. I think too often it's just really easy to basically say like, well, everybody's telling me college is the move and that it'll get me a good job. And that all sounds pretty good. So I guess I should do that. It's easy to make that choice. I think it's hard to say, I don't know. That doesn't sound like a good way to spend my time. I'd rather do this. And like going against that grain is really challenging, but I ultimately think it'll serve you more at the end of the day.
So for anyone that's part of the CollegeWorks program, any special advice you have for them of how to maximize their experience?
Yeah, I think for one, it's set yourself a goal and make sure it's a goal that like means something to you. So like for me, I don't know if you remember this, Sean, but in my interview, like my first interview with you, I came in, I said, I want to do a six-figure business. And you're like, not a lot of people do six-figure businesses. And I was like, I want to do a six-figure business. And there were several moments throughout my time. You know, I remember there was a time where I was like, hey, I'm not producing this work in Salina. It's too far. I've got three teams. I can't manage it. And I remember Nick at the time was like, are you kidding me? Like it's a $6,000, like, you, that would put you under 100 grand. I was like, I'll find another one. Don't worry about it. And I did. And I ended up finding another, you know, thing and selling it. And it was because I had this like very true like goal. It was like, I want to do a six-figure business. And that's the same thing, like follow through on what you say you want to do. And so like that for me was like, I want to do a six-figure business. I'm going to make it happen. And so that made the experience very rewarding for me because I had a realistic goal that I knew I wanted to achieve at the onset and then was able to do the things and able to take the steps to get there. I think like with sales, it's really easy, right? 100K in sales. Well, okay. We did this all the time. Well, if my average, you know, project is X thousand dollars, that means I need to do this many estimates, which means I need this many leads, which means I need to knock on this many doors, go knock on that many doors. Right. So it's like, it's like, again, it's just a math problem. Like it's not that complicated. And that's actually, that exact process was something that I took to, it's one of my goals for this year at my current job around like my involvement with the sales process. I said, I want to do $1 million in sales. I want to be involved in $1 million in sales. And I backtracked it and said, well, I know my average project is about $250,000. So that means I need to sell 4 projects. Well, if I need to sell 4 projects, I know about a third of the proposals that I'm involved with sell typically. So that means I need to do 12 proposals, one a month. Okay. And so my goal was I'll do one proposal a month. I need to involve myself with one proposal a month. I've been involved with three this month. Two of them I'm already sold. One of them happened to be $1 million. And so I've already reached my goal. But like the whole thing is like, it really is that simple. Set yourself a goal, figure out what the parameters are to achieve that goal and do it. And I think with College Works, it's no different.
Awesome, man. Well, I really appreciate you being on the show. Every time I get an opportunity to connect with somebody that I personally worked with, it just brings back a ton of memories and mostly good ones. And I want to keep the conversation going for hours. I want to stay in touch more frequently because it's just super fun to connect with all of our Aldrich's family and see where they're off and what they're doing and kind of how they found their way in the world and how they're continuing to keep exploring it and finding new ways as well. So thanks a ton for joining the conversation today, Keaton.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the invite, Sean. It's been a good time.
I hope you enjoyed that episode today on the Edge of Excellence podcast. Make sure to hit subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to this. If this episode made you think of someone, go ahead, take a screenshot and share this exact episode with them. This show exists to showcase what is possible when young leaders are willing to step out of their comfort zone and choose to excel in their lives. To learn more about our internship for young and ambitious students, www.oneinternship.com/podcast to see if it's something that makes sense for you. Once again, it is www.oneinternship.com/podcast. Let this be a reminder for you to live on the edge of excellence in your business and life. See you next time.